Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
From the DTDT.com studios in downtown San Francisco, now your hosts, Joe Lowe and Dibs on 95.7 The Game.
We're gonna play on and stand strong with Joe Lowe and Dibs. Turn the game on. Bump up the volume. It's time to play ball with Joe Lowe and Dibs. Turn the game on.
Here we go. Wednesday. Joe Lowe and Dibs, 95.7 The Game. It is great to have you in. Lowe's out today, so it's just Dibs and I. Anna's riding shotgun with us as well. Rod Higgins, former Warrior general manager, coming up in about 30 minutes. Ray Searage, mark it down. Uncle Ray, pitching coach for the Pittsburgh Pirates, is going to join us in about an hour to talk about the Andrew McCutchen trade. And of course, the Warriors are in Chicago tonight to take on the Bulls. Tip time, 5 p.m. right here on 95.7 The Game. Coverage will begin at 3:30 p.m. with Warriors warm-up featuring Damon Bruce and Kerry Keating here on 95.7 The Game. Have you and I ever done a show together where it's just been us?
I think so.
I feel like there's got to be at least one on there,
yeah,
right?
One or two in there. There's been a couple where I think Lowe was back maybe at Canton during that time, and we didn't have Cousin Goo in. That seems to be about the time. Maybe last August is when it was.
That's right. All right. Well, it should be relatively easy today. We had a ton of baseball discussion this morning. We've got some interesting things in store regarding the officials, the NBA. Again, last night, right before we jump into the Bochy comments and the Evans comments from yesterday, what is going on in Oklahoma City? I didn't see the highlight until you showed me this morning. No one touched Russell Westbrook there. Why is he so upset?
Yeah. Well, he felt like that he was fouled hard in the face, and so he went up. And if you get any contact at all now, you got to throw yourself to the ground to let them know that you, in fact, have been wronged. Your grandparents have been wronged. Your ancestors were fouled. Come to find out, when you watch the video, Russ's lip got grazed by the defender's wristband. No real cause for alarm, but he flies off the handle. Two tees, you're gone, and just another peg in the board of discontent between players and refs.
I'm wondering if we're paying more attention to this, and this has always been an issue, or if it's becoming a bigger issue. Players fighting with each other. Players fighting with officials, coaches fighting with officials. Does it feel as if this has taken on the next step of its evolution, or has it been like this for a while and we're just now noticing?
I think it's a next step in the re-evolution, because back in the 70s, this was commonplace. And, of course, everyone remembers the Rudy Tomjanovich incident when he was knocked out by Kermit Washington, and his career basically was ended with that sort of punch. And then the Bad Boys was a physical era, but we've gotten away from that until recently, and now we've had a lot of these incidents with teams going through tunnels to find other teams, and last night punches thrown. The NBA's got to get this in order.
Players getting upset that teams might try to honor one guy on another man's night. Like,
oh,
do you see this nonsense in Boston? So next month, the Celtics want to pay tribute to Isaiah Thomas when the Cavaliers come to Boston. They want to play a video tribute, like a four-minute thing. And Paul Pierce is upset because it's the night they're honoring him. And then Rajon Rondo finds out about it and is trying to figure out why, you know, he doesn't get as much recognition based on what he did in Boston and the fact that apparently Thomas is getting too much. I mean, what
did he
go
ever
out
do?
Back and slap each other.
That's
how about that?
Thing.
Go out back and slap each other and settle this thing like, you know, whatever this is these days.
Right. It's not the way it used to be where you'd clothesline a guy going to the hoop. But this, you know,
take him out.
You can't say that on national TV.
No, you can't anymore. Rajon Rondo out of control, and Paul Pierce wants his own special night, so apparently they're not going to honor IT after all in February.
We'll jump into that, plus some very interesting theories Dibs and I have concocted as to the NFL ratings issue in the divisional round. That's at around 6:45 this morning. But we begin with day two. The fallout. Andrew McCutchen, the latest addition to the San Francisco Giant roster. Yesterday, Giant general manager Bobby Evans joined Damon Bruce and had this to say about the defensive alignment of your new look outfield.
We anticipate putting McCutchen in right and Pence in left, and Bo just talked to both of them about the game plan. And again, we'll look seriously at Duggar in center along with external options to solidify us up the middle.
All right, we'll get to center field in just a moment. McCutcheon in right, Pence in left. Was there ever any doubt this was the direction they were going to go? Do you think behind closed doors anyone had an issue with this?
No, when you look at the defense last year from Hunter Pence and Denard Span in the outfield, you had the worst defensive outfield in baseball. And even though right field is something you got to learn, it's not easy out there with Triples Alley and the way the wall comes at you pretty quick down the line in
the
right
Gotham
field.
Club.
Yeah.
The Virgin Atlantic Club.
You've got a lot going on. You've got the fourth archway and all the various other caroms off the bricks. It's going to take Kutch some time to get adjusted to right field, but Hunter Pence just doesn't cover the ground he used to. He doesn't have the best arm, so it was a natural move to put him out in left.
For me, this feels like a season in which anything you get at Hunter Pence that might be average to slightly above average is a huge win. He's battled so many injuries over the last 2 years. He's just following that natural trajectory of a player who's breaking down late. Nothing to complain about there. Nothing to criticize there. It happens with age. He's put a lot of wear and tear on that body, and he's put a lot of wear and tear and blood and sweat into this organization, so you can understand it. But do we see him as a platooning left fielder this season? If so, who are some of the options? Because I'm thinking, what, if you can get 100 games out of him this year and he finds a way to hit 260, you're probably in pretty good shape if he's not a mess out there in left field.
Especially if that 260 comes with 15 home runs, maybe 25 doubles. You know, real impact as far as a power bat in that six hole or the five hole, the six hole. I think that he's your regular left fielder unless he struggles, because you don't have a lot of great platoon options. You mentioned Duggar and the potentiality of center field. This is a kid who hasn't really faced high level, high minors, major league pitching yet. So to include him in a platoon right now, I think is premature.
That's the name that's been coming up for more than a month. Anytime we discuss center field, Steven Duggar. And it's like, well, why? Well, he had this great performance in the Arizona Fall League, and he did. But is that enough? Is that enough? I don't know if we're going to necessarily see him on opening day on the roster. Do you?
No, unless he has an absolutely monster spring and he shows you that he can hit Major League Baseball pitching, even though Cactus League pitching is not real live MLB 162-game pitching. If he shows you something, maybe you break camp with him on your 25-man roster. Personally, based on what I've heard from Bobby Evans and others, I think they're going to slow play him a little bit and not put that much responsibility on his shoulders, because you saw what happened with Christian Arroyo last year. He was elevated at least a half a year earlier than they probably wanted, but they had such problem at third base. They threw him in there. He wasn't ready. He got hurt, and now he's in a situation where he's not even your regular guy. You don't even really have him in your immediate plans.
That's a great point. So that would mean that with the $6 million they have left between the $191 million they've already committed and the $197 million that is the 2018 luxury tax threshold, what can you get to address center field? Jared Dyson is a name that's out there. He's a left-handed bat. He played with the Mariners last year, mid-30s. Not going to bring a lot of power to the lineup, but he does have some speed. He can swipe some bags, and he's an above-average defender, which is probably what the Giants are looking for at this point. You would like to believe that between the money committed to Longoria, McCutcheon, Posey, Brandon Crawford, should he bounce back, Brandon Belt, that you'd have enough power there to be average to above average in that department. So center field isn't going to be a spot where you're looking to add power. You're going to be looking to add defense. Dyson might be one name out there they can consider.
I think also on-base percentage is the key, because the Giants offense, even though you do have an uptick in power, this is an offense that barely hit 100 home runs last year. And so you're not going to all of a sudden be a team hitting 250 and slugging with the big boys, Houston and the Yankees, etc. So you still need to be a move-the-line offense. And so at the top of your order, you need a guy who's going to be high on base. He doesn't have to steal a ton of bases, but just get on base, keep the line moving, have the ability to make a smart out the second time through, whether it's a ground ball to the right side or a sack fly. You need a good hitter and somebody who can get on base.
The best way to take a team's performance from 1 year and try to project how that team will perform the following year is run differential. You plug it into the Pythagorean win expectation formula, and it gives you a number. Now, granted, this isn't the be-all, end-all, but it's a nice indicator. For example, you could have taken a team, or you will take a team like the San Francisco 49ers. You'll plug in the runs scored, points scored, I should say, for football, points allowed. It spits out a formula. It gives you an accurate indicator of how many wins that team should have had.
Nerd alert! accurate. Yeah, I can't really fight that one.
I'm into it. Pythagoras is my homie.
Last season, the Giants were minus 137 in run differential. That was third worst in Major League Baseball. However, that run differential is indicative of a 67-win team, not the 64-win team that they were. So they performed a few games below expectation. Take that into account and then look at how the National League playoff teams have performed over the last 5 years. For example, we have had 6 years now of baseball in which this new wild card system has been in play. You've had five playoff teams per year, so that gives you 30 NL wild card teams. Of those 30 NL wild card teams, or playoff teams, I should say, 30 NL playoff teams, 29 of them, all but one, finished in the top five in run differential during the regular season. So that's what it's telling you. Finish in the top five in run differential. You'll finish in the top five in the league. You'll make the playoffs.
29 of 30.
29 of 30.
Over the past 6 years.
In
that's
the American
remarkable.
League, 24 wow. of 30. So run differential is an accurate predictor. If you put up a very high run differential, there is a very good chance you will be going to the playoffs. For the Giants to get there, they need to turn a minus 137 run differential into about a plus...
A 55?
Right in that wheelhouse. That's almost exactly right. They need to go through a plus 191 swing.
Mm.
And if they can do that, they'll pick up about 19 games, 19 wins, because it's 10 runs per win is essentially what the math has figured out. And from that point, you'll get right up to about 85 wins, and it should get you into the postseason.
That sounds about right.
A lot of math, a lot of numbers there to throw at you early in the morning, but this is what we're looking at if this team wants to turn it around and get to the postseason next
year. So it's 190 runs, basically, which is about a run a game, which means every other game you score one more run, and every other game you allow one fewer run.
Exactly. That's what you're looking at, either run suppression or run production, one or the other.
And hopefully you get a little taste of both because your rotation gets healthier and hopefully better. Your closer comes back and gives you a full year, and you've added these bats. So if you can get both sides of it to work, you can make this massive jump.
That is your math lesson for this morning. Now, it's been widely assumed that at some point the Giants and Madison Bumgarner will reach an agreement on a long-term and very lucrative contract extension. But if you didn't read this Jeff Passan article that was on Yahoo yesterday, your mind is about to be blown as to what is going on with this year's free agent market and how that's going to affect Bumgarner. We'll have that for you next. Joe, Lowe, and Dibs, 95.7 The Game.
Joe, Lowe, and Dibs continues on 95.7 The Game.
Tonight, of course, the Warriors going for 14 straight road victories, which would tie a franchise record set all the way back during the 73-win season of about 3 hours ago.
Hilarious.
And I believe that's two seasons ago at this point.
It seems so much longer ago, Joe. The whole teabagging, I was doing middays with Pop then. And his 20-minute rant that day is probably one of my top 10 moments in my radio career.
It's fantastic.
Sitting here and listening to Pop go off about 3 points of contact and the teabagging and Kiki Vandeweghe and on and on and on.
I was sitting in a car. I don't know why I say a car, our car, at the intersection of 4th and King. So I was coming down 4th, south on 4th. I was going to cross King and get back into our neighborhood. And I was listening to That's Where I Heard the Teabagging.
Yeah.
I remember where I was the day of the infamous teabagging rant.
I was great that day.
I was in the car about 20 minutes. I didn't even know you were on the program.
Yeah, you couldn't. You know, I didn't breathe in the mic or anything. I kept it off mic. Kept it all off mic.
He started, and then I remember Papa just gets progressively more angry, 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 and then it just hits its crescendo, and it's like, man, this is fantastic.
Incredible. But yeah, 2 years ago, and that year they went 34-7 on the road, and this year they're on pace to eclipse that. I believe 20-3 or 21-3 on the road. That's the most mind-boggling part to me about this whole year is that they go on the road, and they are determined not to lose these road games.
They find something to challenge them. They find something to motivate them. And this year, it appears to be, we want to be the best road team of all time. That's what it feels like right now.
Yeah.
So these road games, I mean, I should be looking into point spreads to see how good they've been on the road this season. Feels like I'm a bit late on that one, if I'm going to air it out in front of everybody.
And they got another dozen or 18 road games to go. And you're right, Joe. This seems to be the point of fixation. 2 years ago, it was 73 wins. Last year, it was obviously a redemption song trying to get KD in the fold and redeem what they gave away the year before. And this year, it seems like their motivation point is Maybe we go 37-4 on the road and just put up a number that will never be touched again.
The PenskeAutoSales.com text line asking for the Papa Rant. Maybe if we could find a snippet of it, a really good snippet, because I, you know, this is only a 4-hour program, so we don't have enough time to play the whole rant. But maybe if we find a snippet for you, we will play that in just a minute. Now, while business is booming for the Warriors, it's not necessarily the case for the National Football League. The NFL gave you 4 games this past weekend, 3 of which were very competitive, coming down to final possessions. And yet, ratings are down about 10%. Falcons-Eagles did a 17.4. That's down 5% from the Seahawks-Falcons game last year. Titans-Patriots is down from last year's Texans-Patriots game. Jaguars-Steelers is down 7% from last year's Steelers-Chiefs game. And Saints-Vikings, the marquee game of the weekend, down 23% from Packers-Cowboys last year. This is a noticeable trend. NFL ratings were down last year. We blamed it on the election and the protests. This year, blaming it early on the protests and now a variety of other factors. What's going on here? Has the NFL just hit an unsustainable peak and we're starting to see a slight regression as a result?
We are, and it's a number of factors, and I think there is still some spillover from the election and the climate that it's created in this country where more people are paying more attention to politics, I think, than ever before, because every day there seems to be a new story. Whether you're in favor of what's happening or you're against it, there's something to draw your attention. Additionally, the teams in the matchups, not as good as last year. A lot of them are subtleties, but the fact that you've got Minnesota in, they're not an exciting team. Jacksonville's not exciting. If you're a casual football watcher, now, if you've been watching all year, you know Minnesota's been a great story, and Jacksonville's got the best defense in football, et cetera, but you don't have a lot of marquee names, you don't have a lot of marquee teams, and you don't have a lot of the big top 10 markets. There's no Dallas, there's no Houston, New York's not represented, the Bay's not there, LA was one and out, the Rams went out quickly, so I think all those factors combine with all the options now. People have a lot more going on from an entertainment pie standpoint. Even older guys like me, discovering Netflix late and Hulu and other programming, YouTube, these are all things that are now pulling bigger parts of the audience away from traditional streams.
I think all of that's accurate. I think you can even zero in on a few other elements of it in a more specific fashion. Quarterback play. Quarterback play. The most important thing to any NFL team is going to be the quarterback. Falcons-Eagles this year. Matt Ryan versus Nick Foles. Last year, that game was the Falcons, Matt Ryan, and Russell Wilson of the Seahawks. Which did better? The one with the better quarterback matchup. Fast forward to the end of the weekend. The Saints and the Vikings. Drew Brees, fantastic. Case Keenum, who cares? Last year, that spot was Aaron Rodgers versus Dak Prescott. Prescott was a huge story last year. Rodgers is always a big story.
And the Cowboys are always the biggest story. I mean, they're the highest valued pro sports team in the country, if I'm not mistaken.
Always. So we can break it down from a variety of different factors. And that probably is the overall answer, is that at some point, this growth of the NFL was going to be unsustainable. It was going to hit its peak, its tipping point. And you combine that with the quarterbacks, and we're going to see a decline from the championship games last year to this year, because how many people are interested in Case Keenum versus Nick Foles? Or Tom Brady is a 10-point favorite versus Blake Bortles? Those are not appealing matchups. This leads us right into why you're going to spend $125-plus million on Jimmy Garoppolo. Because it's not just about what he does on the field. It's what he brings to the organization outside of play on the field. And that's interest. It's merchandise. It's TV. It's radio. It's money. It's fascination. Same thing in Oakland. You've got a marketable quarterback. You just got to find a way to fix him.
And you now you've got a super marketable coach who is the new John Madden for your sport, basically. He's maybe the most recognizable non-player figure in your game. So anytime the Raiders have a press conference and John Gruden's out front, you're going to get coverage coast to coast and around the globe. You wouldn't have gotten that with Jack Del Rio. You wouldn't have gotten that with any other coach.
No.
Short of John Gruden. He's the most monster figure in the game. And you have the franchise quarterback. You've got the elite pass rusher, and you should be poised for a step back into relevance next year. I would add to that, Joe, the fact that here in the Bay Area, we're not as as deterred by the protests. We actually led the league in protests with our teams here as far as Eric Reed, Marshawn Lynch, Eli Harold, etc.
It all started here.
It all started with Kaepernick. So the erosion because of that doesn't exist as much here in the Bay Area. The thing that I think that hurts football across the country is the fact that it's become tougher to watch these games. What is a catch? We don't know what a catch is. Everything's getting reviewed. All scores are reviewed. All plays inside the last 2 minutes are reviewed. All turnovers are reviewed. You ice the kicker, all these timeouts. It's become a tougher watch for an audience and a generation that has a shorter attention span.
And leading right into that, Joe in San Francisco, I think he's going to want to weigh in on that as well. Joe, what's up?
Yeah, how you doing, guys? Yeah, I kind of agree with you on that, Dibs, but part of it to me is me being an old guy, you know, they're taking away the fundamental, I guess, the essence of the game. Like, football is a collision sport. It's a violent sport. And I know CTE has a whole lot to do with them, you know, really like kind of winding back on, you know, hits and stuff like that. But to me, it's like it takes, I don't know how you solve it, but it takes something away from the sport when you regulate the essence of the sport. I give you an example. When, you know, that Minnesota play against New Orleans. Now, you know, that was, you know, hey, I was happy for Minnesota because they had a whole lot of tough breaks, you know, over the years. But to see that safety, just, I can't believe a safety not wrapping his arms around the guy when he got a clear shot at him, just tackling the guy. See, fundamentals to me is going way down. And to me, that has a whole lot to do with, you know, taking away what the value of the sport and what attracts people to the sport. The hitting thing is like, yeah, they're regulating hitting. It's almost like, oh, I can't believe it. It's like, okay, the way he got missed that tackle, it's like a guy playing flag football. You know, he would at least stick his arms out and touch the guy.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe, you know, that kind of thing. So for stuff like that, and just like you said, there's all the rules, all the timeouts, all this and that. They're over regulating the sport. It's a violent sport. You got to let it be violent.
Agreed, Joe.
Thanks,
Thank
Joe.
You for the phone call.
Appreciate the phone call. A lot of good points there.
And I,
very quickly, Dibs, hold on. You're listening to 95.7 The Game, KGMC in HD1 San Francisco.
You're right. You're right. I'm wrong.
I don't know who you thought you were trying to get all over my legal ID there.
I thought maybe you'd go willy-nilly and let it slide past the absolute top of the hour, but you are a stickler.
It's the law.
Yeah. You're hardcore over there. Joe makes good points, Joe. Just, I've talked to a lot of people who are casual football fans, and even when they watch the game now, there's so many flags. Every single kicking play, aside from extra points, PATs, there's a flag. Every punt, every kickoff, it's going to either be blocked in the back or hold. Flags that you don't even see. So now we got to show this kick again that doesn't matter. And, oh, there's the hold. There you see the block in the back on the 32. And they'll be back to their own 12-yard line. And let's take a timeout. And it's become a lot tougher to just watch football.
One of the problems, and this is exactly what you're speaking to, is the NFL has been very good at finding a way to take the post-coital cigarette away from sex, to take the dessert away from dinner, right? How many times do you go out, you have a nice dinner, you want to have a dessert with it? It's a nice way to end the meal. The NFL has found a way to take the dessert out of it. You have a nice encounter with someone, and you want to have that cigarette afterwards, right? The NFL has taken that cigarette out of the equation. You don't get that moment of true euphoria at the end because there's the review. There's always something hanging over the product.
Yeah.
Every time your team scores, you've now been conditioned to hold off. Every big play your team makes, you've been conditioned now to hold back rather than just let it rip and celebrate and hug. I mean, even in Minnesota, they're going nuts, but you know there are people like, wait a minute, they step out, they're going to review this.
Was it
what happens
PI?
With the extra point? Yeah, exactly. There's so much that goes on now with all the reviews, the challenges, and all the rules that are in place. Nobody knows when they can even celebrate. You can't just let loose. And that's the whole essence of entertainment and professional sports,
right?
Is that you're able to get away from reality. No one wants their entertainment to be tailored in such a specific, rule-determined, rule-focused fashion.
It's not visceral anymore, and that's the beauty of baseball in many ways, is you see a guy at the plate, and he hits it, and it sails, and you watch it sail, and it goes over the fence, and you know it's a home run, unless it's just down the line and it's iffy, but otherwise, you see it, you know there's not going to be any flag on the home run, and you're either joyous because it's your team, or you're bummed because it wasn't your team, and it's visceral. It happens in real time. It's not nebulous. There's no debate about what happens. And now in football, a lot of these times, if you're watching it on TV, you don't know if there's a flag until they throw up the graphic and it's like a flag on the play, or you don't know if it's a catch or not. You think he got his 2 feet down, but he hit the ground and the ball might have moved a millimeter. We're going to have to wait. And oh, now the red flag comes out, and now we're going to go to New York to decide whether or not I can be happy or sad. It takes away the pure joy of watching it, Joe.
It's
you're
confusing.
Right.
It's just confusing. The game has gotten too confusing. They've overthought every element of the game. Let's think about this. Go back to before this season. One of the biggest issues for the NFL was whether or not players were going to celebrate in the end zone, right? Do you remember when that was such a big deal? These guys can't celebrate. It's a bad example. It's bad for the game. And then finally this season, they come out and they say, you know what? Whatever. You can have group celebrations. Has anyone written an article or discussed this season with the group celebrations, any sort of issues? Are we setting bad examples for the kids, or are we actually kind of enjoying it? The Philadelphia Eagles have had some really great group celebrations.
Yeah.
We saw Minnesota with a great group celebration over the weekend against the Saints. None of that hurts the product at all. No group has come out of the woodwork to try to protest this or say the NFL needs to make a change. But for years, that was the biggest issue for the league. These celebrations. People want it. It's humorous, and you either pay attention to it or you don't. But it's one of the few things that doesn't offend anyone anymore. We haven't taken a single call this year that's like, guys, I got to talk about this celebration thing. These group celebrations is just too much. No, the group celebrations are fine because now we've moved on to this whole, we don't know what a catch is. We don't know if a guy's been in bounds. We don't know the difference between upholding and overturning and standing by and not enough conclusive evidence. You're throwing all this terminology at people. They don't want to go to law school.
Right.
They want to watch a football game.
And you want to be able to just watch the game and have it play out. And that's always been my thing about instant replay, Joe, because we've gotten to a point in America, not just in sports, but in America, where we feel like we can't get screwed over anymore. And newsflash, that unfortunately is a part of every person's life on this planet. All 7 billion of us, at some point you're going to get a bad beat. Whether it's me getting a bad parking ticket a month ago because I'm at a broken meter and the meter maid or meter matron writes me up anyway, that's a bad beat. I got to deal with it. I can try to fight it, and I did, but after further review, I still had to choke over $84. And in our sports now, we're at a point where we feel like instant replay could be this elixir and make it so nobody ever gets bad beats anymore, but you still do. So if we did away with instant replay and just allowed the referees to ref the game, yeah, there'd be bad calls, probably more bad calls, but we'd get back to a time where you could just experience the action in real time and move on.
Do you know why we pushed for instant replay, more instant replay? Because we were tired of coming on air the next morning and talking about how a call was blown in a game and how the NFL needs to fix that. We're still doing that.
Yeah.
We're still coming on air the next day and talking about blown calls. Instant replay hasn't fixed anything. It's just made things more confusing. It's taken a lot of the fun out of the game, and that's the problem. It was supposed to come in and solve the issues, catches, inbounds, scores, and all we have are blown calls that end up leading into the next day. Can you believe this? They blew it on the challenge. They blew it on the replay. No, if it's not going to solve that issue, I don't want it. I was a proponent for the longest time of review everything. Get it right? Now, scrap the whole thing. Just let the refs call the game. And if we're going to complain anyway, let's complain over the human error rather than the human plus computer element.
And I don't think it ever will be able to fix everything, you know, because we watch these plays in slow motion and the game's played in fast motion. And it's impossible to be able to legislate plays that way after the fact. It's just broken, Joe.
Joe Lowendibs continues on 95.7 The Game.
Jeff Passan, an MLB columnist over at Yahoo Sports, had an awesome article yesterday. Equal parts awesome, equal parts terrifying on what's going on during MLB's free agency period right now. At the moment, 51 free agents have signed for $655 million. That sounds like good news. Only 13 of those 51 players are positional players. It's the middle of January, and only 13 free agent positional players have signed. You know who hasn't signed? Jake Arrieta, Yu Darvish, J.D. Martinez, half the Kansas City Royals who are out on the market right now. Like, baseball is in mid. We are less than a month away from pitchers and catchers, and there are so many dudes out there. So Passan spent the last month talking to MLB execs, union reps, players, agents, and what he's finding out is we are reaching a very interesting point in an era of Major League Baseball where teams are realizing the current economic structure doesn't work anymore. like teams have stopped just accepting the fact that they have to give 6-year, $200 million contracts to 32-year-old players who by the end of the deal, they're going to end up in a horrible situation. Teams are realizing that, so they don't want to spend money on these guys anymore. And it's fascinating because if you're JD Martinez, you're looking around like, what just happened? What are you thinking if you're Madison Bumgarner? Honestly, right now, from a local perspective, if you're Bumgarner and you read this article, you got to be thinking, wait a minute. Whoa, 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 whoa. I'm in line for 25 to 30 million times six. I've got that coming to me. You're telling me the market's going to reset itself?
Yes, and I think we're seeing that now, Joe. We've seen previous years where the hot stove was lukewarm and it took slow to heat up, but ultimately just about every player got about what they deserved or what they expected. But this year you're seeing it like we haven't seen it before in modern baseball, where legitimate star type players are out there and they're not getting the money that's being sought. And maybe it's because of Scott Boras, who represents a bunch of these guys who are still out there. And maybe it's the market resetting. But as you head into next year, which is supposed to be the big bumper crop year, Madison Bumgarner has one more year in his deal and then a club option. So they could decide to just keep him under the current contract and he could just wait out the market. But if things don't change now, what's going to happen next year for Bryce Harper, Manny Machado, and others who were expecting to get 30 or 35 million a season? It may not be there.
Now, I think those dudes are getting paid because they're 26. They're right in that 26 wheelhouse. Would have no problem giving an 8-year deal to a 26-year-old. The problem is giving an 8 to 10-year deal to a guy who's 31 or 32. Tickets to give away in about 3 to 4 minutes here. Tim Roy's going to join us at 9:05. Here's an example. This morning, I went through a few of those articles that have like the worst baseball contracts of all time. This is why teams don't want to spend a ton of money now. Robinson Cano, right? He's been balling out for Seattle. No one's going to question that. But Cano's 35 years old and his contract has 6 years and $144 million left on it. Albert Pujols is 38 years old. 38. His contract has 4 years and $114 million left on it.
Wow.
Pablo Sandoval, we all know what happened there. Mike Hampton, when he signed that deal with the Rockies, making him the wealthiest player in baseball, 8 years, $121 million, he lasted 2 years before he was traded. Mo Vaughn, back in the day, signed 6 years, $80 million with the Angels. That was one of the biggest contracts of all time when it was signed. He lasted 2 years, and then he was traded. Jason Bay with the Mets, 4 years, $66 million. Hit .234. With 26 home runs total in 3 seasons, they negotiated an early termination.
Yikes.
I think you can make the case that this has been a long time coming, that you finally have a lot of these analytical minds running these baseball teams looking around saying, why am I going to give you 6 years, $180 million at the age of 31? I might get 2 to 3 good years out of you, and then what? I'm just on the hook for this massive guarantee just to reward you because that's how it's always been done? Baseball's starting to reset itself, and the next CBA is what, 2021? You might have some major changes coming.
Right, and I think the Giants are a team that maybe is realizing this market reset a little bit later than they would have liked, and last year's 98-loss season was a cold, hard slap in the face because you look at your contract situation, and you've got Samardzija at nearly $20 million, Cueto's at $20 million, Bumgarner's at $12 million, but he will be at $20 million, Posey's at $20 million, Crawford's at $15 million or so, Pence is more than 15, and you look around at all these guys now becoming aging ball players. You finally got out from underneath Kane. You were able to move Matt Moore, who had an 8-figure contract. You have all these guys stacked up who aren't delivering peak seasons, and if this year doesn't go according to the new plan, all of a sudden you take a look and you think, well, McCutcheon's just on a 1-year deal, so he's gone, but you're still on the hook for Cueto. You're still on the hook for Crawford and Posey and all these other guys. At some point, you got to churn the roster and start over and save a little bit of money.
Here's the other big problem. Baseball has made it acceptable to lose. If a team comes out now and says, we're tanking for the future, we don't question it. As fans, we don't even rail against them. Houston is the Astros, Chicago, the Cubs. These two teams bottomed out, built up in one World Series. So now that they're showing you it's possible to tank off for 4 or 5 years and then make a run at it, no one's questioning it. Passan's article lays out what realistically could be 10 teams that are not going for it this season. That's a third of Major League Baseball. A third of Major League Baseball is saying, we'll go ahead and we'll take our revenue sharing check. Thank you very much. And we're not going to play to win because we're going to build for the future. That goes against every fiber of why you have revenue sharing. The whole point of revenue sharing was to give the teams in the smaller markets an opportunity to compete with the big boys. But then Derek Jeter and the new ownership shows up in Miami and they just tear the whole thing down. And they say, sure, we'll take our $50, $60 million check. Thank you very much. And we're going to go ahead and do nothing. And the other teams are looking at this like, wait a minute, that's not what this was meant for. They're going to file a grievance.
Right, and the A's were one of the first teams to really effectively do this by not spending a lot and staying below the median payroll level and getting that revenue-sharing money as a, quote, smaller market team. Even though the A's are in a top-five media market, they were able to play the poverty card successfully. But I believe that they and other teams are now off that teat, and the old construct is changing to where they're forcing teams to spend more and be more competitive.
All right, here's an opportunity to win some tickets, specifically a pair of tickets to see the Eagles with Zach Brown Band when they come to AT&T Park on Thursday, September 20th. Now, tickets for this show go on sale this Friday, January 19th at 10 a.m. at LiveNation.com. The pre-sale, however, starts tomorrow, Thursday, January 18th. It's going to run from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. at LiveNation.com. You're going to use the code DOUBLE, D-O-U-B-L-E, DOUBLE. Now, in order to win today's tickets, you've got to call the hotline, 888-957-9570, and answer the following question correctly while being the first to do so. This is the Know Your Show portion of the program. So the longer you listen, the better the chance you'll have to win. Which member of Ginger Nation, is that what we're calling this? Ginger Nation, is Dibs most excited to watch during the upcoming Winter Olympics? 888-957-9570.
And Raider Nation, go ahead and hold your texts about there's only one nation because you, sir, and you, madam, are incorrect because the Sioux Nation predates your precious Raider Nation. So, Raider Nation, you're not the only nation. In fact, Ginger Nation, it's real. And we're here.
That's a particularly spicy take at 8:47.
Factually accurate.
Just go ahead and troll the Raider fan base right
there. Before there was the NFL, there were Native Americans, and the people of the Sioux had their own nation. And, of course, Kerry Nation, the great politician from the 19th century, etc. So there were nations before the Raider Nation.
Ginger Nation probably goes all the way back. Like, when was the first ginger? Prehistoric man?
Yeah, I think the original caveman was a redhead, Joe.
Maybe not the original caveman, but one of. You'd have to figure there was a ginger in there somewhere, right?
Sure, you'd figure. I don't know how the first ginger popped up. I'd have to consult the Bible for that one.
Someone was mating with a woolly mammoth.
On the sixth day, God created the gingers by accident.
All right, so Ginger Nation, Sioux Nation, Raider Nation, Mount Nation more. 888-957-9570. Immediately on the text line, just in all capital letters, Raider Nation.
Exactly. And it's great. I got deep respect and love for the Raider Nation, but it just doesn't mean there can't be other nations, right? The nation state, Kerry Nation, etc.
Yesterday, Bobby Evans, general manager of the San Francisco Giants, joined Damon Bruce to talk about the team's latest acquisition, Pittsburgh Pirate outfielder Andrew McCutchen. Question about where McCutchen would play defensively was answered. Take a listen.
We anticipate putting McCutchen in right and Pinson left, and Boach has talked to both of them about the game plan. And again, we'll look seriously at Duggar in center along with external options to solidify us up the middle.
So before we jump into center field, do you think there is any issue getting this set whatsoever? McCutchen in right, Pence in left. Do you think anyone had a problem with that?
No, no problem at all. And I think in Pence's exit interview at the end of last year, it was a very frank discussion as far as the future for Hunter Pence. He knows that his days as a 162-game, 600-at-bat guy, they're probably behind him due to injury and relative ineffectiveness. If you have Hunter Pence out there for 120, 130 games a year in left field, all of a sudden his defensive deficiencies aren't as big a deal, and maybe with additional rest he can be more productive. The thing I was thinking about, Joe, is the idea of a soft platoon out there in left field where you have Hunter Pence taking the majority of the at-bats, but maybe you try Brandon Belt in left field. You give Belt some time in left. That gives you the ability to play both Buster Posey and Pablo Sandoval at first base and keep Belt in the lineup on those days.
Oh, my God.
It's scary, I know, but defensively...
Defensively, you're taking a huge hit everywhere.
From Hunter Pence, though, to Brandon Belt, I don't know how huge that would be in a step down. And Buster Posey's a good first baseman.
I would like to believe... I would just like to believe that it's not, that Pence isn't that far gone. Belt and left is, I like the guy, but Belt and left is not, it's not an, let's how we say, optimal situation to be in if you're the Giants. That, you know what, that leads me into something I had in my notes for yesterday, and we never really touched on this. With Longoria in the fold, with Bumgarner coming back playing for that contract, with McCutchen in the fold, which player on this team do you think is going to enter the season with the most pressure on his shoulders? Like, you got a massive payroll here, right? You've got a team and a front office. Let's make it clear. They've let you, the fans, know they're going for it. They are not going to throttle back. They are not going to rebuild. You want a competitive product. You want a winner. They're doing everything they can to give you that winner. Remember, they did have a trade in place for Giancarlo Stanton. Stanton was the one that said, no, nothing Bobby Evans can do about that. They went out and got Evan Longoria, the face of the Tampa Bay franchise. They went out and got Andrew McCutchen, the face of the Pittsburgh franchise. Granted, these guys might not be in their prime, but there's enough left in the tank to contribute. So once this season gets rolling, which actual player on the roster do you think is facing the most pressure?
I think it's Kutch, Andrew McCutchen.
Really?
Yeah,
even on a one-year deal?
I think he comes in on that one-year deal, and he's looking to get that best last payday that we talked about that guys aren't getting this offseason. You look at his splits, Joe, at AT&T Park. He's played a total of 28 games there. So not a small sample size. It's a decent sample. He's had 102 at-bats and 3 home runs at AT&T Park. So we talk about Kutch coming in and providing pop to this lineup. AT&T Park is not a place where he's driven the ball. 3 home runs and 5 doubles in 120 plate appearances. That's less than 10% of his plate appearances resulting in actionable power at-bats with doubles or home runs. He also has 2 triples thrown in as well. So 10 of 120 plate appearances resulted in an extra base hit. That's not very good.
Interesting. He's going to be here on a one-year deal that pays in the neighborhood of about $12.2 million because the Pirates threw in $2.5 million. And being that he's only here on a one-year deal, I guess I could see the pressure. I don't know if he's facing the most, though. I don't know if he's facing the most. I mean, you got to figure from a personal standpoint, Bumgarner has got a major amount of pressure on his shoulders because he's looking to get paid. And what about Johnny Cueto? Cueto was the big-ticket acquisition, what, 2 years ago? And I know we're entering year 3, but he opted in. People are going to expect more Johnny Cueto 2 years ago rather than Johnny Cueto last season, don't you think?
Yes, absolutely. And on my pressure list, as we fill up the pressure cooker here, you got Brandon.
Mount Giant pressure more.
Yeah, well, to do the mount, that's tough. I mean, you're probably closer to doing a low Neil top 12 list than you are doing a mount because Brandon Crawford's under a lot of pressure to show whether or not he is that hitter that we saw 2 seasons ago. And how about Mark Melancon, the high-priced closer?
That's a big one.
Melancon came in and didn't close anything but closed up the wound in his arm that's the size of the Grand Canyon.
And that problem is the fact that correlates with, look, you could look to Brandon Crawford and Bumgarner and Cueto. They're all Giants who have done something in the past. Melancon is yet to cut his teeth with the club. Like, he's yet to have that signature Giant moment that kind of gets him in with everybody. Not to say he's on the outs, but you're right. This is going to be a closer you look at this season where, you know, if game 1 is against Arizona, which I know I'm talking about last season, but you get in there, you got to lock that down this year. No one's going to want to hear about the excuses.
35 saves minimum and less than 5 blown for the year from Lance. And Brandon Belt is under a lot of pressure as well, pressure to stay healthy and deliver on being a 20 or 25 home run guy. So you could pick any number of 7 or 8 of these Giants, and they're all under pretty significant pressure. And that's what happens when you lose 98 games. Pretty much everybody in, and you could say Buster Posey's under pressure, but go ahead right now and take your pen or your pencil out and write down 315, 17, and 90, because that's what he's going to give you. He'll hit 35 doubles. He's going to hit over 310. He won't get 20 home runs, but he'll be close. He'll drive in 90.
He's going to contend for a gold glove.
And that's
contend
it.
For a silver slugger.
He's about as consistent as you could ask out of a catcher of that ilk.
You know, Belt's going to be facing a lot as well, because that's the guy who it feels like every time he doesn't produce, I don't want to say above and beyond, but I mean quality all-star level numbers, he takes a ton of abuse. He takes a ton of abuse from a fan base that's pretty receptive to just about everything that goes on, that's pretty lenient compared to a lot of other fan bases in the country. That's a guy who finds himself in the crosshairs more than anyone else. He's battling the concussion thing, so you know the first whiff of dizziness is going to shut him down for a month, and the natives are going to get restless on that one. The natives are going to get real restless.
Without a doubt, because he has shown so much potential, but he hasn't been able to prolong it for an entire season. And you can't help but be tantalized by that. I saw him in single A when I was doing a lot of San Jose Giant games, and he hit 380 in the first half 1 year before getting promoted. And you haven't seen that ability to wield the bat at the major league level.
Michael Urban was in hosting for Towney last night. Urban actually spoke with Boach. Here's what Boach had to say about the outfield situation.
Well, he's going to be in right field. We talked to Kutch, when we made this deal, now he's played more center field than anywhere, but he's all for doing what we think is best for the club. And so with him going to right field now, that moves Pence over to left field, who I talked to yesterday, and Hunter's just so excited about getting McCutcheon over here. And so, you know, it's going to, I think, make our defense better. It's obviously going to give us some more punch on the team. Especially in the outfield where we just didn't have a lot of production.
I love it. I can just see him being like getting the call about McCutcheon is, all right, I got to give this guy a call. We're going to play in right. Great to have you. Honey, just quiet. Hold on. Calls Hunter Pence. Hunter, we're going to move you to left. You all right with that? All right. Let's move on.
It's, you know, it's an easy fix. And I'm sure that they talked to Pence at the tail end of last year and, you know, you had a hard conversation with everybody, whether it was Crawford and or Panic or Belt. Everybody, you had to say, look, here's where you need to improve, and here's what we're thinking for you for next year. And Pence knew that they were going after Stanton, and they weren't going to put Stanton left. Stanton was going to play right field. So Pence has known since the last out of last year that his time in right field was probably over.
They got to set some tone early in spring training, because I'll tell you what, how many years does Boach have left, right? It's not as if this thing turns south early, there are going to be some whispers about this being the final season. So it's going to be important to set some tone early, but we got plenty of time to talk about that as we work our way towards pitchers and catchers. Congratulations to Raymond and Benicia on winning the Eagles and Zach Brown Band tickets. The answer to the question, Sean White. Which member of Ginger Nation is Dibs most excited to watch at the upcoming Winter Olympics? Sean White. That's
Flying
what he
tomato.
Talked about today.
He brings it. He brings it. Even though his hair is more tightly shorn than the old Flying Tomato days, he's still a part of Ginger Nation.
Tim Roy, the voice of the Warriors, with a preview on the Bulls game tonight. Next, Joe and Dibs, 95.7 The Game.
Joe Lowe and Dibs continues on 95.7 The Game.
Very happy to pivot right now to the voice of the San Jose Sharks, ladies and gentlemen, Dan Rusinowski, joining Joe and Dibs here on 95.7 The Game. Dan, I want to start with what a special evening it must have been last night. Mikel Boddicker records his fifth goal of the season. The Sharks win 3-2 in a shootout. It must have meant the world to you to see Boddicker get that fifth goal.
Well, it was great, and what a special night it was. I still can't believe that it's 2,000 games in the NHL for me, but that's what we celebrated last night. And nice that the boys came up with the 2 points, too. It really was an amazing evening.
Ruse, I was screwing with you with Boddicker's goal. We know it was about 2,000 games last night. Congratulations. How's it feel?
Well, it's fantastic. Like I said, Boddicker could have scored a hat trick. It wouldn't have mattered, although that would have made somebody $100,000 richer what we're doing on the radio this year. But let me tell you that it really was special. The reactions that I got from everybody, everybody within the Sharks organization, broadcasters around the league, people like yourselves, really a very special evening.
2,000 games for Dan Rusinowski behind the mic with the San Jose Sharks. I know it's tough to pick out which your favorite moments were looking back. It's like your kids in many ways, I'm sure. All the games, you don't want to pick one favorite. But is there a moment when you look back at the 2000 and think that's a moment when you really felt like you had arrived, or you felt like this is really the most special place for you?
Well, it all began really with the first game in Sharks history back in October of 1991. And a lot of people forget that that very first game that this team ever played was not broadcast on television in the Bay Area. It was radio only, which was amazing in and of itself. But Dennis Hull did the game with me as my color commentator. I'll never forget that. And a kid from California named Craig Cox scored the very first goal in the history of the franchise, which I thought was pretty apropos, although awfully rare for back in 1991. Now we've got more kids playing hockey from the Golden State to all through the state of California, northern and southern. And, you know, that's where it all began. But, you know, if you have to really add up all of them, I can't get beyond that that game against the St. Louis Blues in 2016 when the Sharks went over the top and went to the Stanley Cup final for the first time. Sure, there were a couple of wins to call in the Stanley Cup final, and those were great. But I'll just never forget the tears in the eyes of so many Sharks fans after that game against the Blues that put the Sharks in the final. And to me, that was a special moment.
The great Dan Rusinowski with Joe and Dibs here on 95.7 The Game. I'd imagine that when you hit a milestone like 2,000 games, as you've discussed, so many people are going to ask you, what's the biggest moment? What's the most memorable moment? What's a moment that might fly underneath the radar? It's just some random game, some season where something happened that you weren't expecting, whether it was on the road or home. Does anything like that stand out for you?
Well, sure, there are a whole bunch of things like that. I can tell you that the very first time that the Sharks came back to SAP Center, it was called San Jose Arena back in those days, after they beat the Red Wings in the playoffs in that first playoff year in 94, people forget that they won the game on the road in Detroit, and then their very next two games in round two were on the road in Toronto. So this is game three of round two, and it was the first time that Sharks fans had really gotten together to kind of celebrate what had just happened, the amazing events that had occurred in that playoff run. And I'll never forget the sound of that building, of just how loud it was when the guys came onto the ice, how much appreciation was shown for them. And, you know, another moment like that that comes up, too, was a playoff game against Edmonton back in 2006 when the Sharks were down 5-on-3. And two of the three skaters they had on the ice broke their sticks, and they got the puck out of the zone. I'll never forget that either.
So many memories over 2,000 games. Dan Rusinowski here on 95.7 The Game. It's a tough thing to revisit, but 2,000, you were involved in that car accident that left you in critical condition, and you missed, I believe, the majority, if not the entire season. What was that like for you when you were able to fight through all that adversity and come back to the mic and do the thing that you love so much?
Well, it wasn't a full season. I missed 27 games total.
That's all you missed, Dan, was 27? That's incredible.
Yeah, I'm a hockey broadcaster. We come up quickly. You know, we get over. But I can tell you that it was very serious for a while. And without my wife, Karen, and all my friends and all the Sharks fans that were so encouraging, I might not have gotten through that with the great medical staff that took care of me. But I tell you what, when I went through all of that, the response from the people, from the fans, really made me realize that San Jose and the Bay Area really was my home, and these were my friends, and this is what I was supposed to be doing. And to me, that was the most incredible part of it. You know, everybody's a little bit afraid of death, but I think that in a strange way, that experience made me a little less afraid of it because of what I went through and what I remember from it. And I got a lot of peace from it in that way, and on a personal level. But beyond that, just the reaction from the fans was really incredible. I mean, I remember going back to a game against Vancouver in December of that year. I hadn't started broadcasting yet, and the fans really gave me a wonderful response at that game, and ever since then, and it's just been wonderful ever since.
Maybe it was the enduring of Roxy Bernstein that made it feel like more than 27 games, Dan.
Well, that could be, although he was part of a flight that I didn't have to be on, which was great. That was when I think a bird or something blew out the hydraulic system of the plane on takeoff in Dallas. They take off at Love Field and they land at Dallas-Fort Worth, just a couple of miles away. And the pilot actually had to use the physical guy wires to land the plane. Wow. I'm glad I wasn't on that one.
Yeah, it's a good miss by you, Rusy. It's called the Bernstein Curse, if I'm not mistaken. Thank you.
He's a piece of work.
I love him.
He filled in for a lot of games for me, and there were a handful of guys that did. I think Roxy, I'm sure, did the most of them.
Dan Ruzanowski with Joe and Dibs on 95.7 The Game. Ruz, one of the great mysteries this season in the NHL is the fact that the Vegas Golden Knights, in their first ever season in the league, are smoking people. They're one of the best teams in all the NHL. And not only that, they have this unbelievable home ice advantage. Do you think it's a little something to do with, say, the Roxy flu, like up in Vancouver? Are teams having a little bit too much fun on their first road trip to Vegas?
So you've been to the Roxy in Vancouver, have you?
No, but I've read about it in a great ESPN article, and I've always wanted to go there. It's something that fascinates me.
Yeah, I think you'd be in the Hall of Fame if you ended up there, Dibs, no doubt about it. But I got to tell you that it's not just that. It's the way that the team was built. And I think that, you know, there aren't any real stars on the team, but there are a lot of really solid players. And that's what $500 million buys you. I mean, I was always comparing the expansion draft that the Sharks had compared to the one that the Vegas Golden Knights had. And I'm thinking, wow, I guess the NHL has learned a lot about bringing new teams into the league since then. But because back in the old days, they didn't do too many favors to the new clubs coming in. Although the Sharks did get Doug Wilson in a trade and they did get Kelly Kissio and a few other really solid players and great human beings. But it's a different level when you're losing a 30-goal scorer like Jonathan Marchessault and going over to Vegas to join that team. And, hey, kudos to George McPhee, the GM there, and to the coach Gerard Gallant for getting these role players to play into his system. It just goes to show you that that's where the NHL is and how close the league is when you get solid NHL players put into a team. The enthusiasm and really the way they brought that city together, I think, has been really special to see. And we'll see how it goes in the second half of the year. You never know. But, boy, they're off to a great start.
Ruz, before we let you go, we wanted to play a clip from earlier in the show today. We had Tim Roy from the Golden State Warriors on. We asked him about Dan Ruzanowski, 2,000 games. Here's what he had to say.
I'm so happy for Dan. He's a great guy, and it's well-deserved of any praise that comes his way. He's one of my oldest friends in the business. In the early 1980s, right out of college, I was doing some Colgate hockey in the ECAC, and Danny was the voice of St. Lawrence University hockey. So he and I have known each other since then, and it's so great that we worked together in the same conference, you know, in like 1983, and now we're back together in the same market, and we have been for years. It's really a great fun.
Tim Roy Ruz. I didn't realize you guys went so far back.
Yeah, he's been a really good friend for a long time. I remember those years on the buses driving down to Hamilton, New York, and commiserating with Tim, and a friendship began, and we sort of kept bumping into each other over the years, and wasn't it neat when he moved from Sacramento to the Golden State Warriors, and we've stayed in touch ever since. And, you know, the Sharks and the Warriors get along quite well anyway, but for me, it's just special that a good friend like that for so long is in the same business, and we're in the same city with some pretty good hockey and basketball teams.
Follow him on Twitter at Dan Ruzanowski. He's the voice of your San Jose Sharks, fresh off his 2,000th career game. Dan Ruzanowski with Joe and Dibs here on 95.7 The Game. Ruz, it's always a pleasure. Congratulations again on 2,000. Here's to 2,000 more.
Dibs, Joe, I really appreciate it. Thanks so much.
You're very welcome. Dan Ruzanowski, ladies and gentlemen, 2,000 games.
It's impressive. I mean, really, when you think about 82 in a season, that's more than 20 years. It's closer to 25 years. And the guy was the original voice, and he mentioned it, first game ever not broadcast on local TV, which tells you 1991, just where hockey was priority-wise in the Bay Area in our country, really.
Do we sound that much alike?
A little bit. I've actually heard that from a couple different people. I don't think so, but some people have actually, and we've had many guests now say Dibs or Joe or Joe or Dibs.
Do I sound like an old redhead?
Yes.
Do I sound like a young, angry East Coast whippersnapper?
Yes.
There you have it. I mean, imagine how many hotel rooms Ruz has been in, how many flights he's taken, how many buildings he's been in to call a hockey game.
How many icing calls? How many delayed offsides, you know? How many empty netters? How many times through the five hole?
How would Ruz handle Tony Romo doing hockey color commentary?
He would run him out without a doubt. There'd be no stepping on Ruzanowski. Well, here's Michael Bodker. He's open. He's open, Ruz. Thornton's open.
He scores.
Was that Romo? Or Guru? Scored. Yeah, I think Tony Romo, he's doing just fine. He'll look back at this first year of football and hopefully make the right adjustments.
Do we have the Brent Musburger audio by any chance when he was on VSiN and he was giving Tony his advice? If we could look that up. That was my... He's like, stops his radio show. Tony, listen to me. It's because this is right at the moment where everybody was overwhelmed with the fascination. Wasn't Romo's first game the Raider-Titan game?
Yes.
Because that was him and Nance, right?
And I was far ahead of Brent Musburger in my accurate criticism of Tony Romo. Because when something happens, Joe, and there's broadcasters, I actually listen to what the broadcasters are saying. I don't just go all goo-goo eyes over, oh, Tony's so good-looking, he's so funny. Oh, he called that play right. Can you believe it? He called the slant? What about the other nine that he got wrong, people?
From the 925 on the PenskeAutoSales.com text line. Peer into your future, Joe. In 20 years, you'll be on the other side of the table making ginger jokes.
Wow. That would be a sad statement for your career. Sad statement. And you're only 12 years younger than me, so let's not...
I was going to say 20 years.
Yeah, you're only about 12 years away from being old and angry like I am.
Here's Brett Musburger. Play that.
Listen to him, okay? Tony, get off it, okay? First of all, you're intruding on your play-by-play man, Jim Nance, who's just trying to give us a... We like to watch the game, okay? And you're not going to be... Here's a memo to all of you people who, oh, this is great. Uh-uh. It's not going to happen. The further, the more years you spend away from the league, you're going to know less and less about the personnel that's out on the field. So I'm blowing a stop the hype. Okay, right now.
Wow. Musburger comes out and just salts. That's got to put Russ Musburger in like position one of the Mount Broadcaster more with you.
He's
to
always
come right
been
out
up there.
On day one and just be like, this is not how it's
going to
be.
He's always been high on my list going back to my youth when he was calling all the big games. And also on that list, and I didn't get a chance to say it Monday because I was off, but Keith Jackson, rest in peace. I mean, one of the best to ever do it. The best to ever call college football, or really college sports, period. When you're the voice of a sport, you live on well beyond your years. But RIP to Keith Jackson.
The voice of a sport, some say the voice of the Rose Bowl, the voice of autumn, Keith Jackson.
The voice of a day, Saturday.
Yeah. The voice of Saturday. Imagine that. Like, I would be the voice of Tuesday. Nobody likes Tuesday.
And I think he might even be on Mount Jackson more, which is among the most elite mounts in American history. When you think about all the Jacksons.
It's a lot of good Jacksons.
So we'll just go ahead and end it with Mount Jackson more.
Tomorrow we reveal the...
we'll forget Steiny about and the Guru are coming up next. Tim Bontemps at 11 a.m. Brian Sabian at 11:30. For Anna, for Dibs, I'm Joe. Lowe's back in the saddle with us tomorrow at 6 a.m. Won't you join us right here on 95.7 The Game?
You'd be in the Hall of Fame if you ended up there, Dibs. No doubt about it.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.